the game plan we continue is to use what we have seen so far about the Friedmann solutions as a general background, and then consider deviations from Friedmann behavior. Now, you can think, for instance, about fairly straightforward deviations, such as those that are due to exothermic processes, you know, like formation of nuclei and things like that. And I will talk a little bit about that today when talking about cosmic nuclear synthesis. But more importantly, we can look at the way in which small perturbations from the average cosmic background propagate. And this then amounts to what you might call cosmoseismology. And this cosmoseismology is something that we'll have to consider, because most of the more important results about observational cosmology these days hinge precisely on this, namely to be able to do to follow what happens in detail when you start with a homogeneous and isotropic background. You give it a small perturbation and you ask what happens next. And then, of course, for those of you who are interested in the later universe, the universe where we have stars and galaxies and things, this is exceedingly important, because the small perturbations in the initial conditions of our universe, of the order of 10 to the minus 5 amplitude or something thereabouts, are, of course, the seeds of the structures that we have today, and we literally owe our lives to those particular perturbations. Now, I still owe you a little something about that still pertains actually to the smooth part of the solutions we're talking about. I promise to give you one example of what happens if you compute what happens to the actual makeup of the particles, as we had already realized, and this is of course a key thing in cosmology. When you go further back in time, you give me an energy and I can tell you a time before which the energy density of the universe, the energy per particle, was bigger than the number that you've given me. Incidentally, just as a side remark to show you how curious things can get in cosmology, this is not necessarily obvious. Suppose you go back in the early universe and you say, well, there comes a time that the energy per particle is above the ionization energy of hydrogen, you know, so 13.7 eV. Before that time, the temperature of the universe was higher than about 5,000 Kelvin, and hydrogen was ionized. And you continue this idea. However, you then realize that if you go to an earlier part of the universe, you make two particles out of one. First, you have one hydrogen atom, but when you go to an earlier phase of the universe, you suddenly have two. You have an atomic nucleus, in this case a proton, and an electron. If you continue that, for instance, to the atomic nucleus, you say, well, whatever nuclei there were, previously there weren't like helium nuclei, for instance, but there were separate protons and neutrons. And before that, you can break up the protons and the neutrons in quarks. And maybe there's something beyond that. Now, when you think about the thermodynamics of such an evolving plasma, right, wouldn't it be interesting if rather, if you had excess energy, rather than putting that energy into, for instance, the kinetic energy of the particles, put that energy into making more particles? Yeah, that freedom. E equals gamma mc squared. So whatever you designed to do, it is in theory possible that when you go to earlier and earlier phases of our universe, the excess energy that is there just simply because you have less space in the early universe does not go into increasing the energy per particle, but just simply goes into creating more particles of a species that perhaps we don't know. Oh, maybe there is something beyond the quark level. And that opens the possibility that there is a limiting temperature in our universe. When you go further and further back, the temperature doesn't rise to infinity like it would if you had a finite population of particles. But the temperature reaches a certain maximum, and instead of the temperature increasing, just the population of particles increases. That idea was an idea first put forward by Hagedorn. And there is currently no evidence that that actually happens, but that is just simply because we haven't reached the energies that might correspond to this. right? And just these limiting energies that we currently have at CERN tell us that, well, there is no structure that we have yet observed below quark structure. But maybe in the early universe there was. I'm mentioning this possibility to you because one of the themes that I'm trying to get through in this lecture series is that there is much more uncertain in cosmology than at first you think. When you read the various publications, people all think, oh, it's all cut and dry, you know, third decimal place and so on and so forth. But simple possibilities like this that, in fact, anyone could have thought of are abound in cosmology. You have a question, sir?
That seems to be somewhat problematic because you start at a high temperature and you then decrease, which would mean that particles start disappearing.
No. What I'm in the argument I just gave you, I'm sort of calculating towards earlier times, starting now. Right, so we start at 13.8 billion years, we go back and back and back and back in time. Because there's less and less and less space, that the amount of energy available in a given volume goes up and up and up. And that's just simply a matter of how you distribute that. If then you run time forward, there's a different story. You start with a plasma containing, I don't know what sort of particles. I mean, something on a structure below the structure of quarks. But with a particle spectrum that has a very, very, very large quantity of them. Right. You are probably aware of the fact that if you have a current symmetry theory, like SU3, for instance, you have a finite number of particles that you get because, you know, the number in your SU is just a finite number, it's 3. It is not excluded, however, to think that if you have other symmetry groups underlying that, or unified theories and things of that general sort, or maybe even more complicated ones, that the universe would start with a finite temperature, 10 to the 14 Kelvin, just give me a number, but with a very, 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 very rich particle spectrum. And when you go back to T equals zero, that particle spectrum, if the temperature remains finite, that particle spectrum would in fact have infinitely many different varieties of particles. It is possible, right? Then if the universe expands, that temperature would float at a particular level for a moment until some of these hypothetical particles would combine into a next generation, such as, for instance, what happens when three quarks find each other and they make protons and neutrons. That is a process that we know, right? But then a similar process, an analogous process, but then very much earlier in the universe, and that then finally ended up with the generations of particles that we have today. That's the basic idea. Again, my motivation for talking about things like this is sort of showing to you that there is much more that could still be explored rather than just simply saying, well, it's all cut and dried. All we do is calculate the third decimal in our various expansion parameters. Now, I will at present give you a small summary of cosmic nucleosynthesis. And that is a process that is similar to what I just mentioned, which is why I started on this, where you start with a universe that is so hot that certain particles did not combine yet, in this case, protons and neutrons, and that then started to combine and started to form particles that we have today. Now, the curious thing is that just observing the chemical composition, the global chemical composition of our universe, you already know that something peculiar must be the case. Because 75% by mass is hydrogen, and 24% by mass is helium, and 1% is the rest, and that rest comes from stars. Why is it that in the early universe we didn't get much beyond helium? The curious thing then is that just being observant, looking out and looking at this general chemical makeup, you already have reason to conclude that there is something really bizarre going on at early times. And that bizarre thing, of course, is the expansion of the universe. The nuclear synthesis that went from hydrogen to helium could not go any further simply because the universe was expanding. So the fact that the universe is expanding is already, in a way, present in the mass ratio of the hydrogen and the helium in the early universe. That immediately tells you that the early universe must have been, in this respect, very far out of equilibrium. Now, this sounds like a contradiction, because I already mentioned to you, sort of anticipating what we will see in the second lecture today, namely the extreme smoothness of the cosmic microwave background, 1 in 100,000. I already mentioned to you that the very early universe was exceedingly close to thermodynamic equilibrium. How then could it be that those nucleosynthesis processes that we're about to consider apparently were so far out of equilibrium? And the reason for this is that in those days, our universe was exceedingly photon-dominated. When giving you the overview over the contents of our universe that I've given you at several on several occasions during these lectures, we've seen that there is something between 10 to the 9 and 10 to the 10 photons for every baryon in the universe, which means, imagine that you started with two protons in the early universe, and out of those two protons you want to make a deuteron. That's the next step up, as it were. As soon as you've managed to do that, which is not trivial, because one of those two protons would have to turn into a neutron. We'll talk about that in a moment. Once you've done that, you have a deuteron that is embedded in an enormous sea of very high energy photons. So the next thing that would happen is that your preciously newly formed deuteron would be photodissociated by the hard photons that abound. And the probability of this is very, very large, of course. Now, you might say that that's not a concern, because all you have to do is wait. And indeed, that is true. All you have to do is wait until the universe has diluted itself sufficiently that the sticking of these atomic particles together would be sufficiently frequent and the photon gas would be sufficiently dilute that that photo dissociation is not important anymore. Besides which, of course, as you're aware, the photon wavelength, because the stretching of space, the photon wavelength scales with the expansion factor, with the scale factor, which also means that the energy scales inversely with that factor, and therefore the mean energy of your photon spectrum goes down, and photo dissociation ultimately is not important anymore. Now, the nice thing about this is that the reactions you can already anticipate occurring very far out of equilibrium. And that is nice, because if you end up with the result of a system that is at or exceedingly near thermodynamic equilibrium, then by that very fact, it doesn't carry much information. There is hardly any information at all in an equilibrium plasma. But if you get a result very far out of equilibrium, then it is possible to calculate back and find a very sensitive measure of what has actually been going on in those days. And that is precisely what people do in cosmic nucleosynthesis. For instance, I have no time to explain to you how the details of this work, but one of the things that cosmologists have been able to establish is that in all probability, there are no more than three families of elementary particles. You know that there is the electron family of elementary particles, there is the muon family, and there is the tauon family. But nothing forbids you to come up with yet a fourth family of elementary particles, with quarks that are even more massive than the S and the C and the T and the B quarks and things like that. But apparently they don't exist, which is curious, and it is funny, because one of the cases where cosmology actually has something to teach to the people who do elementary particle physics. Now then, there is, as usual, no need to copy things from the blackboard. I'm referring in this particular case to chapter 11 of my lecture notes, but every now and then I will put things on the blackboard in order to see, to have some sort of foothold about this whole thing. Well then, effectively, what we're interested in is when is your KT of the order of the mc squared of the proton, right? Well, you know what that is. It's this just we know from the laboratory. It's 938 keV. And all you have to do is go to one of those solutions that I mentioned to you in the previous lectures and just read off on that scale when that temperature is reached. And already there, watch out, you are you're building in a particular model universe. So if you have reason to believe that the cosmic parameters like a row, unlike k, unlike lambda, are slightly different. In that case, of course, you would find a time when this energy per particle is reached, which is slightly different from another one, perhaps. Now, the corresponding time is the temperature is approximately 10 to the 13 Kelvin. That, of course, you knew. And let us now see what the corresponding background model universe tells us. We had seen that, in this case, the expansion factor can be given in two particular cases as a function of the dimensionless time. Again, you will recall that this is time in units of the current age of the universe, as t to the 2/3. Again, in order to make things scale properly, I'm concentrating on the Einstein de Sitter solution, right? But I had already mentioned that others could be taken instead. Tau sub e to the power 1/6 times tau to the 1/2. This would be for the non-relativistic, and that would be for the relativistic branch of the equation of state. Okay, so this would be the photon-dominated part, and that would be the the non-zero rest mass dominated part. Well then, from this you can compute what happens to the density. I'm just simply referring to that later on. You'll find this in equations 11.8 and 11.9. Going to give this to you. The density of the baryons would then be the density we have today times the following time factors, time to the minus 2 in this case, and time to the minus 3/2 in the relativistic case times the prefactor, so e to the minus 1/2. And for the zero rest mass particles, I'm using gamma for the photon, right, but all zero rest mass particles basically behave in this way. Again, the same kind of thing, tau e to the 2/3 times tau to the minus 8/3. It's always nice, this Einstein de Sitter stuff, because it scales all these powers of t. That is very pleasant, tau to the minus 2. All right. These curves, effectively, you have seen already on one of the diagrams that I've shown to you on the computer last week. Now, the reaction we're trying to find is the following. Sorry for this, I'm not doing this very well. Yeah, okay. Okay. No, I'm sorry, I'm not doing this right. Yes. Okay. Effectively, what we then have to do is ask what is the probability that two nuclei, this particular mass energy, will find one another. And what you then get is that your mean free path is, of course, 1 over the density times the interaction cross-section. And what we typically need to know is what is the timescale for this. Well, the timescale for this, of course, would be this divided by the typical velocity. So this is your collision timescale that you get. What we then do is we compute what the average velocity is. And that is very straightforward. You know from this, because it scales with v squared, that your velocity would be proportional to the square root of your temperature. And that, of course, you can then connect, that temperature you can connect with the densities over here. Well, if you follow through when this timescale is approximately equal to the expansion timescale of the universe, you find a time during which there is time enough for such a reaction to occur. And the basic reaction is so simple that it is hardly worth writing down. You just simply have one species, yeah, plus another species, okay, goes into two other species of this general sort, right? So those of you who have ever followed a course in basic chemistry will think that this sort of reaction is entirely straightforward. In our particular case, it is slightly more complicated because of the weak interaction, which makes that it's actually three particles on the right-hand side, So the basic reaction we have is one hydrogen and another one hydrogen, so that's just your chemical symbol for the proton, first starts to make deuterium. However, in this process, one of these protons will have to change into a neutron, and it is that weak interaction that limits the reaction rate, so you get a positron from this, and of course, in order to make the weak interaction complete, you get a neutrino. So this is what you would see on a chemical level. On a quark level, of course, this is a little bit more complicated, but we know how to compute these things, right? So if you look at your nuclear cookbook, this is what you would find. The question one can then ask ourselves is, does this first step, in fact, occur properly? And as I've already mentioned, yes, it does. However, you have the following difficulty, that you then get a gamma plus a 2-1 deuterium goes into, and then that's, of course, it's an equilibrium reaction, a reciprocal reaction like this one over here. You get a proton and you get a neutron, all right, of this sort. And because the number density, you all know Boltzmann theory, right? Because the number density of this is so fantastically high, there's a very, very, very heavy, there's only a very small arrow like this, and it's a very heavy bias in this direction. And you just have to wait until your time has progressed to a point that this particular temperature has gone down sufficiently. And then when this temperature goes down, this velocity goes down, it's in the denominator here, so this time here goes up. And you get more time for doing this particular reaction. It turns out that it is possible to compute what all these various reactions do. Those of you who are interested in looking at the details can find a number of figures in the book by Kolb and Turner, which I recommended in the lecture notes. And effectively, what then happens is the following. First, you go from hydrogen to deuterium. Then you go from deuterium plus hydrogen, of course, you get my drift, right? You go to helium. And it would be very nice if you were to continue from helium to lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, etc., etc. Now, the reason that this doesn't happen very much, and that after lithium, okay, nothing very much happens, is that the lithium nucleus happens to be very fragile. I mean, this is something that you can just get from your cookbook, from your nucleochemistry cookbook. And therefore, reactions of this type, and also collision reactions of this type, where you simply have an incoming proton or an incoming neutron, just blast these things to bits. So there is, technically speaking, a little bit of cosmic lithium left over from the very early universe. However, in abundance, it is down by a factor of approximately 10 million compared with the other atomic species. And after this, it is kind of hopeless. Now, you might think that this is not a very good argument, because after all, after having dealt with these fragile low-mass nuclei, you still get to carbon. I mean, those of you who have, just a small side remark, those of you who have been taking classes in stellar structure will realize that the lithium nucleus and those light nuclei like this are in fact so fragile that they're destroyed in stars. I mean, not even in the core of stars where the nuclear reactions occur, but way outside that. Right? Lithium just simply gets destroyed as time goes by. You might say, however, look, the carbon nucleus consists of three helium nuclei, effectively. And is it really quite stable? So why is it that we don't see this? Why is there no cosmic carbon worth speaking of, other than of a 10 to the minus 15 level or something thereabouts, as compared with the ordinary species like hydrogen and helium? The reason for this is that the carbon nucleus has a series of energy states that are unreachable by the particles at the time that the universe has the proper reaction temperature. Technically speaking, the name for this is a resonance. There is a nuclear resonance in the carbon nucleus that prevents it from taking part in any of these reactions. And that is why all the carbon that you and I are made of was made in stars and is not something that was left over from the universe. Because all these processes occur so far out of equilibrium, you can compute them in very, very good detail. Right? You don't have a Boltzmannian distribution of abundances, like chemical abundances. No, you have to compute it again and again and again for different model universes. This is one of the ways in which people can try to find what, for instance, the expansion rate, the Hubble parameter, was in our very early universe. Because, as you realize, if you have to wait until the universe has cooled down sufficiently for destruction reactions of this to become unimportant, effectively you're already building in the expansion rate of the universe, because that tells you how long you will have to wait. After all, the Hubble parameter is an inverse timescale. I decided to present this in a little bit detail, even though those of you who are not interested in chemistry might find this slightly off topic, because these reactions of this type are in fact similar to what we do and find with other forms of particles. So effectively, you might say, well, I'm going to go to an earlier time in the universe and I wonder where all the protons come from and where all the neutrons come from. So you have precisely the same argument, except where here we are talking about the merging together of two protons, or a proton and a neutron, as the case may be. Then we will be talking about the coming together of quarks. Now, as you can easily understand, that for the formation of baryons, so the baryogenesis, this is a little bit more complicated, because there is three particles that make up a baryon. Right, so the proton and neutron consist of three quarks, and therefore reactions of this are slightly more complicated. Even so, the net argument that we have given here is the same in all of those cases. Unfortunately, this is yet another instance where I would have to say that doing the real numbers in cosmology is exceedingly hard. I mean, all I can do is say, well, if you want to compute it, go and do the numbers. But you can already see from this exposition that it is not something that you can find and write down a very simple analytic solution, not even an approximation. I can say, well, you know, it's easy to understand because such and such. And that makes life a little bit harder. Well, then, once we have done our sums in this respect, we have been looking at the particle behavior of our smooth universe, it is time to leave that smoothness behind. Now you might say, well, there is no smoothness on a particle level because the universe is grainy on the level of protons and neutrons and things, but that is not what I mean. The total amount of fluctuations that is associated with the particle behavior of our universe, that is to say the protons, the neutrons, and the quarks and things, is so fantastically small. All right, they're just thermodynamic fluctuations that we can leave them out of consideration. Let us consider first what it is that we expect to observe of this, and then we'll go and try and compute how we find, how from our observations can work back to what happened in our earlier universe. Now, suppose that I am looking at a particular model universe, looking out in space is looking back in time, and ultimately any line of sight will find a temperature in the universe that corresponds to the ionization temperature of hydrogen. We are surrounded by a sphere that originally had a temperature of the order of 3,000 Kelvin or thereabouts, and that temperature has been stretched out by the stretching of space to the temperature that we observe today, which is just under 3 Kelvin. The photosphere of our universe, the glow of the Big Bang, the microwave background radiation, we can then observe all around us. And we can ask ourselves, how can we deduce properties of the early universe from the properties of that microwave background radiation? And that is going to be the main subject for now and for the next two lectures. The basic physics of this is relatively straightforward, owing to the fact that it turns out observationally that the fluctuations from average in the microwave background radiation are exceedingly small. I already mentioned of the order of 10 to the minus 5. Which means that those temperature fluctuations, and there again, this is a 10 to the minus 5 type number, are so small that from now on we can hope to fruitfully use linear theory in trying to understand what is going on. And that is very nice, because it means two things. First, it means that when looking at the microwave background radiation, all we need to do is ask ourselves what linear perturbations do. The second thing is that if we want to find the origin of those fluctuations, which will be oscillations of small deviations from the average in the early universe, that those oscillations will also have infinitesimal amplitudes, which makes the total analysis a lot easier. I want to make one small remark at this stage, which is too technical for the main course over here, but just so that you know. I already mentioned that when looking out, you see the photosphere of our universe. But you know from stellar theory that the photosphere has a finite thickness. To us, it may seem that the sun has a hard outer layer, and that's just simply because the transition from ionized to neutral is so very, very sharp, so very neutral. But it is not zero thickness. So when you look out at the microwave background radiation, you can expect there to be a certain thickness of atmosphere, as it were, that you observe. Now, doing the actual computations of that, shall we say, cosmic atmosphere, okay, the thickness of the transition layer from when the universe was ionized to when the universe was neutral, is exceedingly complex. It is easily as complex as it is in the case of ordinary stars. I mean, stellar atmospheres, you know, there's a whole libraries written about stellar atmospheres, so you can understand. This is something that we will just leave for the moment, right? It's just technical details that we will not consider. How, then, are we going to relate a observed temperature fluctuation, because this is something that our satellites will observe for us. We'll talk about the WMAP satellite in a moment and about the Planck satellite. How are we going to relate that to the behavior of the matter in the early universe? Well, that's relatively straightforward. For every potential fluctuation, there is a temperature fluctuation owing to the gravitational redshift. When you look at a massive object, right, such as, for instance, the sun or a neutron star or something thereabouts, you will observe that a clock inside that potential well ticks more slowly, as seen by you at great distances, than your own clock that you have in your wristwatch. We call that the gravitational redshift, and that is, in a way, very similar to the kind of redshift about the expansion of our universe that I was talking about, except in this particular case, it is not the stretching of space as the universe expands, but the different structures of space, the stretching of space, as you climb out of the potential well of, for instance, a neutron star or an ordinary star. So the linearity of a problem immediately allows us to draw conclusions about what the distribution of the potential is, the gravitational potential. And you might say, look, you know, gravity doesn't exist, it's all general relativity theory, but there again, the linearity of the problem is going to help us, right? This then, of course, also means that this is 10 to the minus 5 or something thereabouts, that the corresponding deviation in velocity is exceedingly much smaller than the speed of light. And therefore, linear, non-relativistic theory is going to be applicable under these circumstances. You always have to bear in mind that this need not be so. It just so happens that our universe behaves this way. If you design your own universe, you can make these fluctuations as big as you jolly well please. Right. Well, let's consider. First, you have this gravitational redshift. But think relativistic. When you observe something that is gravitationally redshifted, you see the time is ticking more slowly. But at what time cosmically speaking, given the overall background of our universe, at what time do you actually observe it? That depends, of course, on the rate at which the universe expands. So, this is the gravitational redshift. I'll just write it down. All right, that's just simply if you have a potential well and you look into it. Now, there is another effect. When you know why relativity theory is called relativity theory, time's relative, okay? Which means that if you see something at a different time, you have a shift in time, a difference in time. And that is also 1 over c squared times delta phi. But in this particular case, you are seeing the universe at a different time. So the time that you read off on your background solution, on your Friedmann solution, is slightly different from what it would have been if you just simply had a completely smooth universe. You then have to translate this time shift into a temperature shift to compare the two. And you already know that the cosmic scale factor, oh, I just wiped it off, that is not very clever of me, in any case. Your cosmic scale factor is proportionate to t to the 2/3, okay, that is effectively your Kepler's third law. This would be different, it would be t to the 1/2, if the universe would be in a relativistic equation of state, okay. So that you can use to put this in your time scale, that will allow you to get a temperature. Temperature scale is 1 over a, as you realize, which means that from differentiation, you get a factor 2/3 over here. The gravitational redshift makes your temperature, the effectively observed temperature, go down. You are effectively looking at an earlier time in the universe here because of that gravitational redshift than at an earlier time the universe was hotter. So these two terms have the opposite sign. This is 1, that gives you a factor 2/3 over here, and so what you finally have left over when you compare the two is a net temperature shift, which is 1 minus 2/3, which is 1/3, times delta phi over c squared. All right. Now, if all you are interested in is the power spectrum, and we're going to be talking about that in a moment, I mean, how many fluctuations of a given size are there, this factor of 1/3 is not so very interesting. However, if you want to observe the actual level of this, and our radio astronomy friends can actually do this, then, of course, this is totally essential. If you didn't take this into account, you'd make a 70% error. Okay. This particular expression here has a name. It is called the Sachs-Wolfe effect. And I've just given you a scalar estimate of this, but as you realize, if you want to really compute this when going through time, you can also do it a little bit more accurately, but that hardly matters. Okay. The next thing is that having found this relationship with the potential, you will, of course, want to relate this to the overall density distribution in the universe, because you don't measure a potential. It's not an observable, if only for the fact that a zero point is not determined. You know, however, that the potential obeys Poisson's law, and therefore, if you say delta phi equals 4 pi g times the density, all you have to do is put a little delta in front here, and then you can immediately relate the change in the potential that you find from the observations of the cosmic microwave background temperature to the fluctuations in density. You might worry about this a little bit, and you might say, well, are we absolutely certain that this density is all in particles with a non-zero rest mass? And the answer is yes, because we are in a later state of the universe. You may recall that one of those diagrams that I showed to you last week showed that the transition from photon-dominated to baryon-dominated in our universe, in fact, occurred well before the temperature of the universe was 3,000 Kelvin. Right? It could have been the other way around, but it wasn't. Good. This then allows us a program. The program is the following. You go and observe the fluctuations of the microwave background temperature. You relate those to the density fluctuations via Poisson's law over here and the Sachs-Wolfe effect. And then you say, good, this is what I observe. How did it get that way? How is it that the universe ended up with this particular fluctuation? Moreover, if you were to observe the microwave background and were to make a plot of all sky, I'm going to ask myself, what does that look like? And of course, you know the images, but I'll show them to you later on. There is a certain amount of a certain size associated with these fluctuations. And what you can then do is you can look at the fluctuation of the temperature as a function of size. And what I mean with size, in this particular case, all I know is an angular distance in the sky. But for a given model universe, as we had seen in the various graphs that I gave you last week, for a given model universe, you can translate the angular size in the sky to a length scale at the time that you observed it. Then what you can hope to do is to make a plot of this. And that is to say, you have an amplitude of the perturbations here as a function of wavelength, the size of these things. Now, typically what people do is they don't do this in terms of the size, but in terms of the inverse size. And then you get some sort of spectrum. The question then is, can I fit this shape spectrum, you know, with a certain level of fluctuations at a certain angular scale, can I fit that to the early universe? How would you fit that? You would have to know how, during the expansion of the universe, various oscillations propagated. That we will consider in a moment. It's just simply a matter of knowing how sound propagates. So effectively, the equations that govern ordinary sound under ordinary circumstances, such as here, are already relevant there. That happens while the universe is expanding, however, we'll put one more twist in this whole thing, and that is going to be the final remark for this particular session. As we had seen in our previous discussion, if you plot the logarithm of cosmic time versus the logarithm of any scale in the universe, could be a scale factor, it could be a mass. In this case, I'll take a mass. You can see that the horizon mass scales approximately in this fashion, with a break when there is a transition from the relativistic universe to the non-relativistic universe. Consider now what happens. I start at the very early universe, somewhere over here. I have a perturbation, a delta phi, or in this particular case, a delta rho, corresponding to a certain mass. Let that be here, for instance. As long as that perturbation has a mass that is above the horizon mass, nothing possibly could happen to it, because one part of that perturbation doesn't know that the other part exists. It's outside its horizon, so there's no physical connection, not even a physical connection possible between those two ends. As soon as that perturbation crosses the horizon size, it becomes possible for signals to travel from one side of that perturbation to another. And from that point onward, that perturbation could start to oscillate. Then this perturbation would start to oscillate in one way or another, and the amplitude might go up, it might go down. Let's leave that for the moment. We can compute how it goes, but that's something for later. And then at one particular point, the universe recombines and we observe the cosmic microwave background radiation. At this point, the amplitude that we observe is frozen. It imprints itself on the observations of the cosmic microwave background. So when I look at the CMBR here, for every scale, for every angular scale in the sky, I can find what the amplitude should be that I observe. And then, of course, we really want to compute it the other way around. Look at what we can vary. Several things. we can vary the initial amplitude of that perturbation. We can vary the initial mass of that perturbation by putting it here or there. And in particular, we can vary the stretch of time between when it comes in the horizon and when we can observe it. And this, of course, is a way in which the model universe is folded in. Because this line over here is for the Einstein de Sitter model, but another model universe would have looked very different. Okay, would have had a horizon that does something like this, I don't know, I mean, it's just sketching. In that case, the time between coming into the horizon and our observing it on the microwave background radiation would be different, which means that the oscillation would be at a different phase and at a different amplitude. That we will see back in the microwave background radiation. And this is the way in which you can inspect the universe when we cannot physically observe it. Everything before the decoupling of matter and radiation is not observable by electromagnetic radiation, which you simply can't look in, like you can look in, you can't look into the sun, right? And yet we can observe it by doing this cosmoseismology. Just as in the case of nuclear synthesis, I hope that you are aware by this sort of hand-waving exposition that actually doing the numbers is exceedingly complicated in this case. Those of you who are interested, on the website of the WMAP satellite and on the website of the Planck satellite, you can find tools, script tools, with which you can actually do this sort of thing more or less yourself, right? But it's a black box. It's got all sort of stuff inside that you don't have any control over. There's several things that need to be done now. One is we need to look at a little bit more of the details of this particular process so that you really understand what the progress of things is, because absolutely everything in current cosmology, they even call it precision cosmology, follows this type of recipe. All right. And the second thing, as always during these lectures, what we have to consider is where the uncertainties lie. What is it that we know for sure in this particular way of looking at things, and what could really be modified?